there is an even chance that the United States would plant weapons of mass destruction, just because it would be just too politically difficult for Tony Blair and George Bush for them not to find anything.
There is another American dream, which lurks in shadow and speaks only in whispers of its designs. The proponents of this other American dream look at the world in terms of empire. They seek to achieve hegemony over great swaths of strategically important territory and will do whatever is necessary to gain this control.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Monday, September 29th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Iraqi insurgents ambushed U.S. convoys with roadside bombs and rocket-propelled grenades today, triggering an 8-hour battle in which the American military, in a display of force, sent in fighter jets, bombers, helicopters, and tanks. One U.S. soldier was killed and three were wounded. And in northern Iraq, U.S. soldiers launched 24 raids, arresting 92 people and seizing weapons and ammunition. One of the raids involved the largest joint operation between U.S. military police and American-trained Iraqi police. About 200 Iraqi officers took part. Iran has acknowledged that additional traces of weapons-grade uranium have been found on its soil, but argued they came from abroad, a claim UN and other experts said cannot be discounted. The United States and its allies accused Tehran of running a secret nuclear weapons program, and Iran's acknowledgement was expected to strengthen those arguments. Over the weekend, President Bush and Russian President Vladimir Putin urged Iran to abandon its suspected nuclear weapons program. Iran is facing an October 31st deadline to bare its nuclear secrets set by the International Atomic Energy Agency Board of Governors. If the board rules at its November 20th meeting that Tehran has violated the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty banning the spread of nuclear arms, the Security Council could impose diplomatic or economic sanctions. The ousted Palestinian security chief said today that his people were better off before they launched their armed uprising, but a jailed leader of the revolt told an Israeli court he has no regrets. Despite such conflicting views, there was little public debate among Palestinians as the Intifada, which has killed thousands, brought economic ruin, and all but snuffed out peace hopes, entered its fourth year. In Gaza, several thousand rallied today to support the struggle. Also today, Yasser Arafat, suffering from flu, summoned his personal physician, who arrived at the Palestinian leader's office with a team of medical experts. Arafat suffers from tremors in his lower lip, which doctors have called a nervous tic, but some speculate may come from Parkinson's disease. In another development, the New York Times today carries an op-ed piece by columnist William Sapphire regarding a tip from an Iraqi that led to the priceless Mask of Warka, the Mona Lisa of Mesopotamia. The mask was found buried on an Iraqi farm. In the same article, Sapphire suggests that someday an Iraqi technician may eagerly direct us to a sack of deadly germs, he says. The implication being that somewhere in Iraq there may be chemical and biological weapons as yet uncovered. Sapphire goes on to say that such a find would be treated with suspicion by those who have, quote, a stake in the failure of the search for weapons for mass destruction. Ray McGovern, retired CIA agent under the Reagan administration who gathered sensitive material on Saddam Hussein during the Reagan-Bush era, spoke with Peace Watch today about the likelihood of finding banned weapons of mass destruction in Iraq.
As you may know, in our movement, Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, we often discuss things that seem outlandish but that could happen, namely, would the United States of America plant weapons of mass destruction? And we have a free forum, and we exchange ideas freely, and I have found myself way out on the one end of this spectrum in suggesting that, yes, there is an even chance that the United States would plant weapons of mass destruction, just because it would be just too politically difficult for Tony Blair and George Bush for them not to find anything. Now, that's something that if I heard myself saying that 6 months ago, I would say, well, McGovern, you're getting a little paranoid. But watching the use of forgeries and distortions and lies of all kinds, I do not rule that out. And here we have a sort of the dean of all Republican-oriented pundits suggesting Hey, he uses the word surprise, just like David Kaye used 2 months ago. There may be a surprise here, and it could be a hidden sack of deadly germs. Now, this is precisely what I have been suggesting to my colleagues as a likely course, or at least a 50-50 chance course, that the United States and Great Britain will resort to, rather than having to admit before the whole world and their own populaces that, hey, there aren't any weapons of mass destruction.
Well, even if, as William Safire suggests, a sack of deadly germs is found and then everybody goes, aha, we told you there were weapons of mass destruction, would that vindicate the Bush and Blair administrations, given the kind of testimony that Secretary of State Colin Powell made before the UN?
Well, no, it won't. Even Safire suggests, or such a find of this kind of sack of deadly germs would be treated with suspicion by the Legion with a stake in failure. He says that the world would not believe that this was found legitimately, that it would be found to be contrived or planted. So that's number one. Number two, would it convince the British populace? No way. No way would it convince the British populace that this was a casus belli, a reason for war.
Oh, how about the American populace?
Well, now, there's a more difficult proposition. The question to me is whether the trauma of 9/11 and the free ride that that has given the president and his coterie of PR masters, whether that trauma has worn off to the extent that the American people can look at the mess we're in now in Iraq and say, hey, no weapons of mass destruction? And John Lacey, our neighbor, killed in Iraq? There's something really smelly here. What's going on? And if that happens, then the president and the folks that led him down the garden path here will be in serious political trouble.
I mean, seriously, you actually feel that the U.S. would go so far as to plant weapons of mass destruction, and you cited forgeries and lies told heretofore. But that's a pretty serious charge.
I very much regret making that charge, and I almost feel embarrassed to make it. I am embarrassed to make it. But I have watched what has happened over the last 6 months. I have watched the executive branch of this government use a known forgery that didn't make any sense on the face of it to persuade Congress to relinquish its authority to declare war to the executive. That is a constitutional crisis of considerable proportions. Using forgeries, using exaggerations, hyperbole, distortions has become the coin of the realm here in Washington. And so I do not rule this out. This is going to be a terrific political price if they turn up nothing after all the brouhaha about how sure they were. And I'll say it one more time for Americans who need to be reminded of this. That report was the only thing they had to persuade Congress that the first sign that Saddam Hussein had nuclear weapons could be a mushroom cloud, okay? And that mushroom cloud was referred to by the president on October 7th of last year, by Condoleezza Rice on October 8th, by Victoria Clark, the Pentagon spokeswoman, on October 9th, and on October 11th, the Congress caved and gave their right to wage war to the president.
Based on that forgery.
Correct.
But former Ambassador Joe Wilson, his name has come up in the news again today, and as much as the Justice Department is seeking to investigate who leaked information about his wife to the press, compromising her position as a CIA operative.
Yes. Yes, this is a very serious matter. When I heard this happened, I was just, I was beside myself. I was shocked. You know, the normal person probably doesn't know what this means, but this person was under deep cover. Now, what does deep cover mean? Deep cover means that she was functioning in a capacity necessary to portray that she had no official connection with the U.S. government, okay? In other words, she was acting under false pretenses, and the informants or the agents that she was able to recruit in this effort, they would be and are now in serious jeopardy. Now, often physical jeopardy, once foreign intelligence services make the connections, and the connections, of course, are very easily made, anyone in touch with Valerie Plame. Now, Valerie Plame, and this is really the payoff for me, she wasn't an economist counting the banana crop in Haiti, okay? She was an undercover operative working on weapons of mass destruction, how they are funneled to rogue regimes, how they might be gotten by Iraq or Iran or Syria or something like that. This is, you know, number one national security problem for us. And the network of agents that she had worked out over the many years, because she was able to pretend she was other than who she was, has now been blown. And that loss is a palpable piece of damage to our national security, and that's demonstrable, okay? So you ask, well, why did Karl Rove do this? Well, the answer is that Ambassador Wilson had the courage to speak out and to say the president was not speaking the truth in his State of the Union message when he repeated the old canard about Iraq seeking uranium in an African country. And Joe not only said that, but although Joe is a consummate diplomat, he permitted himself to say to the Washington Post that, quote, this begs the question as to what else they are lying about, end quote. Now, a diplomat doesn't usually talk about lies, but Joe is just so outraged at the distortion of this intelligence report that he permitted himself that. Now, Joe has said on more than one occasion, I measure my words carefully. And the last time he said that was right after he named Karl Rove as the source, at least one of the two sources, for the outing of his wife. Why did they do it? Well, the White House didn't want anybody else to be speaking truth. They didn't want anybody else to come out and say, look, the White House is telling lies. And the way to do that is make an example. And so they dragged not only Ambassador Wilson, but his wife through the mud, and that's what that's what the warning is to others who would speak out like that.
Do you trust the White House or the Justice Department, rather, to investigate this matter?
Reminds me of Richard Nixon when he ordered a thorough investigation of the Watergate scandal. I don't trust John Ashcroft in any sense, and the question will be whether there are enough people with integrity in the White House and in the FBI to insist that when a very serious security breach, a felony under federal law occurs, that really it is an abnegation of responsibility not to investigate and not to bring those guilty to justice.
Well, it seems as though former Ambassador Joe Wilson has already identified Karl Rove, and you seem to be somewhat confident that he's the one, I guess, based on Wilson's statement. Where might this investigation begin, and how long is it likely to take if he's already been identified as the person?
Well, the investigation has not yet begun. 2 weeks ago, the FBI was asked whether they have an investigation on this. Of course, it's been months since this happened. And they said, no, we're still considering it. And today they said the same thing. So it really will depend on whether enough public pressure can be put on the FBI to force the director and Ashcroft to allow an investigation to take place. I understand that some Democratic senators are pushing for an independent investigation, and of course that would be the best way to go. But I don't give that much chance. When I referred to what Ambassador Wilson has said about Karl Rove, I already said this, but it really is a very telling thing that Ambassador Wilson said. You know, I measure my words carefully. Now, what does that mean? That means to me that Joe Wilson, no foreigner to infighting in Washington as well as overseas, has his ducks in a row. He's got the proof. And if the FBI will take this on, Karl Rove will be uncovered as the source. And if legal procedures are followed, he will be prosecuted and put
And finally, Ray McGovern, you mentioned the name of former Ambassador Joe Wilson's wife. Has that name been revealed publicly heretofore?
Yes, it has. And the reason I feel free to mention it now is because Condoleezza Rice yesterday confirmed that that it has been referred to the Justice Department. And so up until now, all of us have been required to speak in the subjunctive mood. Mm-hmm. Now we can address it directly in the indicative mood, so to speak.
And so she was hired basically to investigate weapons of mass destruction.
Well, the way it works, and it's a very good question, the way it works is a CIA staffer comes on board. A need is identified. Let's say we need to be in touch with companies or individuals who are in the business of illegally shipping prohibited weaponry or weaponry stuff to places like Iraq. Now, you can't have a CIA officer under official cover, let's say in Damascus or let's say in Beirut, trying to recruit agents to follow this subject, because no agent with that kind of access would be seen dead near any official representative of the U.S. government. And so you have to contrive a story, and you have to find a place in some non-official NGO or corporation for this CIA official to function from. And that is an incredibly delicate, difficult, expensive operation, because it all has to be backstopped. And this person has to basically live a lie for usually about 10 years before there's any credibility attached to her or what she does. And then she can start recruiting agents, and the agents don't know of her U.S. government affiliation, and so they feel free to give her information. And as soon as that is blown, these agents, known to be in contact with this woman who is now revealed to be a CIA agent, those folks are in really serious trouble, and some of them are in jeopardy for their lives. You know, in my experience, I can recall I was a Soviet analyst, and one of our major requirements was to find out the workings of things like surface-to-air missiles, which could shoot down our planes. And we had a person who was born in an Arab country, educated there, but came over to the States and married an American and became an American citizen, and recruited that person and sent him back in this kind of unofficial job capacity, deep cover. And guess what he did? He, through a relative, came across the specifications for the SA missile most in use in those days, and this is way back in the 60s. And he gave us those plans, and so we could defeat those missiles, and so could the Israelis to whom we gave that information. And it was just a major coup in terms of what we acquired. But somebody blew his cover, and the next we saw was him hanging from a lamppost for a whole week in the capital of the country to which he was assigned. So that's what happens to folks like that, the folks that really do the good work. And when I consider, if I were working in the CIA right now as a deep cover agent, and I see what happened to Valerie Plame, I would just be aghast, and I'd be wondering whether I can really rely on my country to protect me, given all the travail that I've gone through, to basically live a false life.
Ray McGovern is the spokesperson for the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, or VIPS, a coalition of former intelligence officers from various intelligence agencies. McGovern is a 28-year veteran intelligence agent who gathered sensitive material on Saddam Hussein during the Reagan-Bush era. White House spokesman Scott McClellan said today at the daily briefing that Karl Rove was not involved in leaking the name of Wilson's wife. Quote, "The president knows he wasn't involved. It's simply not true." Well, tomorrow marks the one-year anniversary of Pacifica's Peace Watch, so we're delving into our archives all this week and presenting some of our favorite and most memorable pieces from our past 256 shows. Today, we present William Rivers Pitt, co-author with Scott Ritter of War on Iraq, What Team Bush Doesn't Want You to Know. Speaking last December at Boston University, Pitt placed the current situation in Iraq in an historical context.
The history of Iraq did not begin with the Gulf War. Iraq is an industrialized nation of more than 20 million people. It is bordered on the north by Turkey and Syria. Iraq's western border lays against Jordan. To the south is Saudi Arabia, and to the east is Iran. Nestled against Iraq's southeast corner is tiny Kuwait. Iraq is almost completely landlocked. Near the town of Umm Qasr is Iraq's only access to the Persian Gulf. 200 miles to the west of Iraq's border sits Israel, Lebanon, and the Mediterranean Sea. The history of Iraq in the 20th century is dominated by the effects of Western colonialism, American interventionism, dangerous indigenous leadership, the Cold War, and oil. Iraq holds the second largest proven stores of petroleum on the planet, making it a sweet plum for Western industrialized nations. In 1917, British forces invaded Mesopotamia and occupied Iraq, making it a British mandate. Rebellions against the British in Iraq were put down by systematic aerial bombardment, the first time in history such tactics were used. It would not be the last. The borders which define Iraq today, along with the borders of most other Middle Eastern nations, were drawn arbitrarily by the British and the French in the early part of the century. These demarcations knew nothing and cared little for tribal or religious connections that make up the cultural essence of the Middle East. In 1921, the British Colonial Office drew a new line in the sand, carving a border across southern Iraq to create the nation of Kuwait. This was done to deprive Iraq of access to the Persian Gulf. 70 years later, when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, he claimed the nation to have always been a part of Iraq. When considering the British penchant for drawing and redrawing maps in the region, there appears to have been merit to his claim, if not to the actions that followed it. In 1932, Iraq was recognized as a sovereign state and joined the League of Nations. The king remained a British creation, however. It was at this point that the chaos that has dominated modern Iraq truly began. In the years immediately after the end of World War II, a newly powerful America began to consider with cold pragmatism where its own self-interest lay. American policy in the Middle East, a policy that has existed to this day, a policy that has played an enormous part in the recent history of the region, can be summed up succinctly in the words of famed U.S. State Department official George Kennan. Kennan, one of the wise men described in the seminal work of that name penned by Walter Isaacson and Evan Thomas, became one of the primary architects of the new world born in the aftermath of World War II. Kennan, in 1948, crystallized American intentions in the Middle East when he said, quote, "The U.S. has about 50% of the world's wealth, but only 6.3% of its population. In this situation, we cannot fail to be the object of envy and resentment. Our real task in the coming period is to devise a pattern of relationships which will permit us to maintain this position of disparity without positive detriment to our national security. To do so, we will have to dispense with all sentimentality and daydreaming, and our attention will have to be concentrated everywhere on our immediate national objectives. We need not deceive ourselves that we can afford the luxury of altruism and world benefaction. We should cease to talk about such vague and unreal objectives as human rights, the raising of living standards, and democratization. The day is not far off when we are going to have to deal in straight power concepts. The less we are then hampered by idealistic slogans, the better." Unquote. This hard-eyed assessment of American priorities came fully into play in 1951, when Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh took power in neighboring Iran and declared that Iran would retain full control of its own oil resources. Within the next 2 years, Mossadegh was deposed and the Shah of Iran installed, due in large part to support provided to the coup leaders by the CIA. Upon his installation, the Shah received assistance from American General Norman Schwarzkopf Sr., father of the famed American general of the Gulf War, in the formation of the fearsome Savak secret police. The Shah became a puppet of American interests, and the people of Iran began a long bout of suffering under his rule. Across the border in Iraq, a man named Saddam Hussein was at the beginning of what became a long, bloody journey through the politics of power. Born in 1937, Hussein joined the Socialist Ba'ath Party in 1956. In 1958, the British-installed king of Iraq was overthrown in a popular revolt by Abd al-Qasim. In 1959, Hussein was one of the assassins involved in an attempted coup against Qasim, who was wounded in the attack. The coup failed, Hussein took a bullet in the leg, and was forced to flee the country to Syria and then Egypt. The years between 1963 and 1968 were chaotic for Iraq. Another CIA-aided coup overthrew Qasim, and the Ba'ath Party briefly took control of the nation. In 1968, Saddam Hussein helped lead another revolt, which made General Ahmed Hassan Bakir leader of Iraq. The Ba'ath Party was in control for good, and Hussein was named vice president. From this position of power, Hussein developed a vast network of secret police designed to root out and destroy dissidents. In 1972, General Bakir nationalized Iraqi oil. President Richard Nixon immediately began to plot the reversal of this declaration, just as America had done when Iran nationalized its oil in 1951. Nixon, along with the Shah, orchestrated the arming of Iraqi Kurds against Bakir. Tell me if that sounds familiar. Iraq was placed on America's list of nations that sponsors terrorism. In 1975, this course of action was abruptly halted when Vice President Hussein and the Shah reached an agreement that ceded control of the strategically vital Shatab al-Arab waterway in the Persian Gulf back to Iran. In retrospect, it seems clear that Iraq's control of this waterway was the primary concern behind America's agitation against Iraq. Once the American-controlled Shah owned the passage to the Gulf, all American support to the Kurds ceased entirely. In comment upon this, newly resuscitated Henry Kissinger stated, covert operations should not be confused with missionary work. Under Nixon, the arming of Iran by America was dramatically stepped up. The conflict that erupted between Iran and Iraq cannot be fully understood unless the imperatives of the Cold War are completely appreciated. America dreaded the rise of Soviet influence in the region, given the incredible strategic importance of the vast petroleum reserves there. With the Shah fully under the control of the United States, and with Iran in control of the Shatab al-Arab waterway, American interests in the region were safe. Declassified documents from the National Security Archive make it all too clear that concern regarding Soviet influence dominated American behavior in the region. 1979 became a year that changed everything in the region, and conflict between America and Iraq became assured. The Shah of Iran was deposed, overthrown by a popular revolt fueled by nationalism, anti-American sentiment, and fundamentalist Islamic rhetoric. The Ayatollah Khomeini took power, setting the stage for decades of tension and strife with America. During the coup, the American embassy in Iran was overrun by insurgents, and the American diplomats within were taken hostage. For 440 days, they were held, bound and blindfolded, to be paraded before cameras broadcasting the humiliation of America around the world. This hostage crisis assured continued enmity between Iran and America and was the central factor in the electoral defeat of President Carter by Ronald Reagan in 1980. Almost simultaneously in 1979, Saddam Hussein overthrew General Bakir and took full control of Iraq. His all-encompassing influence over the Ba'ath Party became cemented in one bloody day. Hussein convened all of the major power brokers of the Ba'ath Party in one room. These men sat in terrified silence as Hussein read aloud the names of all his rivals in the party. Those named were hustled from the room by secret police loyal to Hussein, brought outside, and shot. From that day forth, challenges to Hussein were rarely undertaken. In the aftermath of this upheaval, American National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski publicly encouraged Iraq to attack Iran and take back the Shatab al-Arab waterway. With the Ayatollah in control of Iran, Soviet influence in that nation increased dramatically. The Carter Doctrine was established in 1980, stating that America would intervene militarily in the region to assure its access to the oil. In that same year, Saddam Hussein's armies invaded Iran, instigating a ruinous war that lasted for 8 long years. The invasion was instigated as much by American urging as it was by Hussein's dislike for Islamic fundamentalism and his desire to control Iranian oil. The arrival of Ronald Reagan to the White House heralded a sea change in relations between America and Iraq. Fearing the rise of Soviet influence in Iran and fearing an Iranian takeover of the region, the Reagan administration began actively arming and supporting Saddam Hussein. By 1982, Iraq was removed from the list of terrorist-sponsoring nations. By 1984, America had restored full diplomatic relations with Iraq and was actively sharing military intelligence with Hussein's army. This aid included arming Iraq with potent weapons, the providing of satellite imagery depicting the deployment of Iranian forces, tactical planning for battles, assistance with the arrangement of airstrikes, and assessment of damage done after bombing campaigns. It was during the Reagan years that the seeds of our current crisis were sown. American involvement became murky, morally ambiguous, and two-faced in the extreme. In several aspects, it became patently illegal. American fears of a powerful Iran motivated policies that ignored terrible actions perpetrated by Iraq. At the same time, American interests in the rest of the world motivated illegal military support for Iran by the Reagan administration, even as it aided Iraq during the war. The New York Times published a report in August of 2002 detailing statements by senior military officers involved with aiding Iraq during the Reagan administration. These officers claim that the Reagan administration was fully aware that Saddam Hussein was using chemical weapons against Iran, but continued to support him. President Reagan, Vice President Bush, and several senior national security aides supported this covert program that provided American military assistance to Iraq, even as they knew Iraq was using chemical weapons on the battlefield. In early 1988, the Iraqi army, with American intelligence assistance, retook the Fao Peninsula, once again giving them access to the Persian Gulf. Defense intelligence officers visited the battlefield, where they found areas marked off as having been chemically contaminated. Containers of the drug atropine were scattered all around, having been clearly used by Iraqi soldiers to inoculate them against the chemical weapons in the event they should blow back across their lines. 1988 was the same year that Saddam Hussein reportedly used chemical weapons against the Kurds in Halabja, an action roundly condemned at the time by American officials. These same officials knew Hussein had been using chemical weapons against Iran, but had continued to support him. The battlefield use of these chemical weapons and their purported use against the Kurds is a fundamental part of the basis for George W. Bush's claims that Saddam Hussein must be attacked and removed. In the middle of the conflict, the Reagan administration began covertly dealing with Iran in order to secure the release of a number of hostages being held by the Ayatollah's government. Arms, including 1,000 TOW missiles, were sold to Iran, and the money generated was delivered to the Contras in Nicaragua in order to finance their insurgency against the socialist regime there, which the Reagan administration could not abide. Such actions in favor of the Contras had been expressly forbidden by Congress. When exposed, the Iran-Contra scandal nearly brought down the Reagan administration. A detailed analysis can be found in Theodore Draper's excellent book, A Very Thin Line. Iraq's war against Iran came to an end after a ceasefire was signed in 1988. The war had devastated the Iraqi economy, motivating Hussein to announce a $40 billion program to peacefully rebuild his nation. This proved impossible. The other Gulf states had been dumping oil onto the world markets, intensely devaluating the price per barrel of petroleum. Saddam Hussein found himself in crushing debt, but with the largest army in the region. America, worried that its ally of so many years might turn upon his neighbors, redrafted War Plan 1002 in 1989. Originally designed to counter a Soviet threat, War Plan 1002 became 1002-90, officially designating Iraq as the main threat in the region. In 1990, America warned Baghdad against any provocative actions against its neighbors. Primary among America's concerns was the possibility of an Iraqi attack upon Israel. These warnings went unheeded. In May of 1990, Saddam Hussein accused the other Gulf states of waging economic war against Iraq. The debt Hussein had amassed in his war with Iran had become a threat to the existence of his nation, motivating him to desperate action. By July of 1990, Hussein had accused Kuwait of plotting to destroy the Iraqi economy by slant drilling for oil into Iraqi territory. Hussein claimed that Kuwait was in fact a province of Iraq and not a separate nation in and of itself. Iraqi troops massed on the border of Kuwait. On August 2, 1990, Saddam Hussein's armies invaded Kuwait, drastically altering the balance of petroleum power in the region and threatening American access to oil. On August 3, 1990, the United Nations passed Resolution 660, condemning Iraq for the invasion of Kuwait. On August 6, the UN passed Resolution 661, levying economic sanctions against Iraq in order to compel them to leave Kuwait. This was a devastating blow, as Iraq imports 70% of its food. By September, Iraq was forced to begin food rationing. By December, the infant mortality rate in Iraq had doubled. Still, Hussein refused to withdraw from Kuwait. By November of 1990, some 400,000 troops from an international coalition formed by President George Herbert Walker Bush had been placed in the region. A great deal of these troops were based in Saudi Arabia, home to the sacred Islamic sites of Mecca and Medina. The arrival of these troops in Saudi Arabia infuriated a wealthy Saud named Osama bin Laden, who had made a name for himself while fighting against the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. As America steeled itself to attack one threat, it gave birth to another.
William Rivers Pitt is co-author with former U.N. Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter of War on Iraq, What Team Bush Doesn't Want You to Know. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.